the Gospel of Luke in chapter 6. Perhaps I should explain for those of you who are not with us in the mornings why we are turning to this chapter. We are in the course of a series of studies in Luke's Gospel on Sunday mornings just now, and this morning we took what I suppose is a kind of telescopic view of the whole of chapter 6 of Luke, and I thought it would be of some value to us to turn to the second half of this chapter, and while not to look at it microscopically instead of telescopically, at least to come a little closer to the teaching of this really important section of Luke's Gospel and of the Gospels generally, which we call the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm going to take it for granted that this is Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount this evening. I was suggesting this morning that it was the new lifestyle that Jesus is here describing for the new creation of which he speaks in chapter 5 of Luke. He uses rather vivid illustrations to describe how what he does, what he has come to accomplish, is no mere mixture of a little bit of religion, as it were, into the old life. He says new wine, the new wine of the gospel, has to be put into new wineskins, or else it will burst them, because it is filled with the vibrant life and power that would break through old traditions and old containers. And he is speaking about a new creation when he speaks about what he accomplishes in the lives that he touches. And chapter 6 really describes this new lifestyle. And in this particular section from verse 20 especially, the Sermon on the Mount is really the new lifestyle that belongs to those who have experienced the new creation. Now that's an important point by way of introduction for this reason. There is a classic misunderstanding of the Sermon on the Mount and a classic misuse of it, which goes something like this. People will say, all you need to do in order to be a Christian is to try as hard as you can to keep the Sermon on the Mount, to live by these ethical standards that Jesus set up. And if you do, or do as best you can, you will be accepted by God and enter the kingdom. Now the trouble with that advice is that, apart from being untrue, is that it is a desperately despairing counsel. It leads people into despair, because again and again they come back from the very attempt to do that sort of thing. To keep the Sermon on the Mount, to live by Jesus' ethical standards, to do what he says and shape our lives in this form. And we say, what I need is not a lecture on how to live, but a Savior who will change my life. What I need is not moral counsel, but a transformation in my character. What I need is not somebody to come and called me by high standards, but someone to put a new heart in me and make me a new creature. My dear friends, nothing less than that is what the authentic Jesus does. He does not merely come to mix a little religion into your previous pattern of life. He comes to make you into a new creation, so that Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, if any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away, behold, the new has come. And here in the Sermon on the Mount, what we are reading is not Jesus' advice to those who would enter his kingdom, but the marks of newness of life for those who already have. It was James Denny, that great theological figure in the life of Scotland in another generation who said, "We do not enter the kingdom by trying to keep the precepts of the sermon, but by receiving salvation from the preacher." That is from Jesus. So the theme of the Sermon on the Mount, and it's important for us to establish it, is not how to enter the kingdom, but how to live as a member of it. It presupposes the miracle of God's grace in our lives. Now that leads me to the details of the sermon itself, which are really just the marks of a work of God's grace, the evidences of new life. And you need new life. Let me say it again before you can live by Jesus' new lifestyle. It may just be that there is somebody listening to me at this very moment, and this is precisely your problem, that you have been trying to live the lifestyle of the Christian without ever having received the new life that is in Christ to enable you to live it. And there is a real sense in which there is only one person who can live like this, as we have been reading this evening, and that's Jesus. And in a sense, this is a marvelous description of Jesus' life. And what he does, you see, is not to stand outside you as a lecturer, but to enter into you as a Savior and then to live out his life through you. I was suggesting this morning, and I want to repeat the suggestion this evening because I haven't really changed my mind since this morning, that there are three particular revolutions that Jesus describes in this sermon. A revolution in values, first of all, from verse 20 through to verse 26. Secondly, a revolution in attitudes from verse 27 right to verse 42. And thirdly, a revolution in priorities from verse 43 to the end. Let me look with you, and it will inevitably again this evening be in some sense in outline, at the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount under these three headings and in this particular way. First of all, a revolution in values, and this is what the grace of God does in the life of the Christian. Verses 20 to 26 are really Jesus' description of true happiness, of the kind of man who is to be congratulated or envied. The word blessed really means that. It does not mean that such a man will never have difficulties in his life or never will have days when he is down and unhappy, but it does mean this is the kind of man who is to be envied, the kind of life that is to be sought after, the sort of person you would congratulate. And he says, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven." And if you look at it carefully in these various forms in which Jesus describes it, it really is a complete reversal of secular thinking. What Jesus is doing is turning the world's set of values upside down. After all, who does the world think is the man to be envied? Who is the person to be congratulated? Who would we say is someone who is truly happy? Is it not the man who has things like wealth and health and plenty and freedom from cares and popularity? Well, Jesus says, "Blessed are you who are poor, hungry, weeping, hated." And when he looks at the opposite condition from verse 24, because there is a symmetry about the construction of Jesus' teaching, and he goes through these very conditions in the reverse form, he says, here is somebody to be pitied.
Woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Verse 25, woe to you who are well fed now. Woe to you who laugh now. Woe to you when all men speak well of you. Here Jesus is saying, what a pity for these people. Woe is not a sort of threat of judgment. The word really implies, what a pity for these people. They are to be pitied. God have mercy upon them. That is what he is saying. What a shame for them. They are not at all the kind of people you ought to envy. They are the sort of people you ought to look at and say, what a shame that they have landed in this appalling situation. Woe to those who are rich, those who are well fed, those who laugh now, those of whom all men speak well. Now the extraordinary thing is that Jesus is saying that the mark of the new creation is that the members of it will prize different things from the men of the world. That's what he's saying. He is saying they will set their values by a different scale. They will have a different form in which they look at people and say, that's the kind of man I would like to be. That's the sort of condition I would like to be in. Now you can test so much of your life by this. You can test whether the marks of grace are there in your life or not. What is the kind of man you envy? What is the sort of condition you long to be in? If you look at somebody, who is the man of whom you say, I long that I might be like that? Because Jesus says that the things the world values highly, we may well regard as tawdry and trivial. And the things the world regards as insignificant, we may regard as the choicest blessing that we can ever have in this world. Because we will test them by a different standard. And as you live through the world in our generation, my dear friends, a world of which I think it was the former President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, said, looks like a shop window where all the price tags have been changed and the cheap things are highly valued and the things that are really of significance are marked down. That's the kind of society that we live in today. And the mark of the child of God is that Jesus Christ has revolutionized his values. I saw it. I remember many years ago in the life of a student who had graduated with great distinction from this university in medicine. And somebody was talking about the possibilities of her future, where she would go, what achievements she would have, what distinctions would yet lie before her. And then she announced that she was leaving it all and going to missionary service in a remote part of the world. And somebody came to her wondering whether much learning had perhaps turned her mind a little bit. And they said to her, but you recognize you will never get on in the world that way. And she turned and said two simple words. Which world? Which world? And that's the great issue, my dear friends. Which world is it that you are interested in living in? That leads me to emphasize the second important thing about this list of qualities or characteristics of which Jesus speaks, and that is that primarily, it seems to me beyond doubt that Jesus is speaking here not about natural qualities, but about spiritual qualities. That is, he is not simply speaking straightforwardly about natural poverty, hunger, sorrow, and persecution, because by themselves they are not marks of grace. And it's an important thing for us to recognize this. Jesus is not saying, blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. That is the qualification for entry into the kingdom of heaven, is natural financial poverty. Because clearly that is nonsense. Not all the poor are in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus is not saying that the qualification for being in the kingdom of heaven is poverty. Neither is hunger. The fact of hunger is not an evidence of the grace of God either. Neither is weeping. Weeping by itself may be produced out of a bitter spirit. There are tears that are tears of anger and resentment and bitterness and physical poverty and physical hungering and physical weeping are not primarily what Jesus is speaking about.
What he is speaking about are spiritual qualities, as he elaborates in the 5th chapter of Matthew in the form the Beatitudes have there. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And what he is speaking about is that spiritual poverty which is the particular mark of the man in whose life Jesus Christ has wrought the new creation. Now here is one of the primary hallmarks of a real work of grace. What is it that Jesus is speaking about? He is speaking about the man who has seen himself as God sees him. He has suddenly had all the imaginations that he had about himself, all his high notions and his exalted views of himself, collapse like a pack of cards around him, and he sees himself in his naked poverty before God with nothing of himself that he may bring into God's presence, no claim on God's mercy, no offering that he may bring to him, no plea that he may make of anything of his own. His language is the language of the hymn writer. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace. That's the language of the man who is poor in the eyes of Jesus. And it is the language of the man who recognizes that he is a poor, helpless, needy, lost, condemned sinner in the eyes of God. My dear friends, have you seen yourself like that? That's a really important question for me to ask you this evening. Have you really seen yourself like that? Is that how you see yourself this evening? Are you seeing yourself more clearly like that as the days go by? That your real condition is that apart from the riches of God's grace in Jesus Christ, for everything in the world that matters, you're a pauper. And there is not an iota that you can do to earn anything with God. You see the reverse, verse 24. Woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. I don't think Jesus is primarily speaking to those who have got money. What I think he is doing is saying beforehand precisely the same as he says in the book of Revelation chapter 3 to the church at Laodicea. You remember that church at Laodicea? They were all professing Christians, you see. And they said when the exalted Christ came amongst them, they said, we are rich. We have acquired wealth and do not need a thing. And Jesus says, you do not realize that you are wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire so that you can become rich. But the real tragedy of these people in Laodicea was precisely this tragedy. Woe to you who are rich. What a tragedy, says Jesus. These are the men to be pitied. You notice the other things that Jesus says. Not only do they discover themselves to be poverty-stricken before God, but they find that they have a new hunger for God. Verse 21, blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. That's what has happened with the work of the new creation within them, you see. They discover that they hunger and thirst, as Jesus says in Matthew 5, after righteousness. Now that's a foreign thing to the natural man. He does not by nature hunger after God. By nature he flees from him. That's why so many sophisticated
20th century people are saying today that they do not need God. He is not a concept they require in their thinking. Now, they're not being advanced intellectuals.
They are just acknowledging how desperately blind and dead they are in the presence of God. But the man who has known a work of grace, my dear friends, what he will experience is not that he is a great achiever, not that he boasts of great attainments. He will say with the apostle, I do not count myself to have attained or arrived, but I press toward the mark. Oh, says Paul, I've set my heart on something different now. God has given birth in my soul to an altogether different ambition, and it masters and overmasters me. I have a hunger now for him that is altogether new. Nothing cheers my spirit more than when I find people who come to me and say, I don't know what it is that's been happening to me recently, but I have begun to have a desire for God. Blessed, says Jesus, are those who hunger. Woe to you, verse 25, who are full, who have no hunger, who are complacent, satisfied, who've never known your soul racked with the sense of a desire for God. And a hunger to be changed. But more than that, says Jesus, the man who finds himself in this condition before God is a man who not only is aware of his poverty of spirit and of a new hunger in his soul, but of a new area where his heart begins to break and he weeps. Now again, I say to you, these are not merely the tears of nature. Because you see, there are tears of grace as well as tears of nature. And the difference between tears of nature and tears of grace is that only Christians weep the latter. Everybody weeps tears of nature. At suffering, at sorrow, at separation, at disappointment, in all sorts of different ways. But there are tears of grace as well as tears of nature. They are the tears of penitence, the tears of sorrow over sin, the tears that are wept so often in private because I have grieved God and broken his law. Have you wept them? George Whitfield says, the child of God is known as much by the things that make him weep as by the things that make him rejoice. And it is true, of course. And that's why Jesus says, blessed are you who weep now. Woe to you who laugh now. That is, who have never known tears of penitence. Tears of compassion, tears of grace, like the tears that Peter wept, and the tears of compassion that Jesus wept over those who were lost. You weep these tears. The Apostle Paul certainly knew what it was to weep them. The same is true, it's another mark of grace. When he turns to the reaction of others to us, blessed are you, verse 22, when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil. It may be that these are the words that are used for exclusion from the synagogue, and some think they are, but in any case they are really just the reaction of others to the disciple of Jesus. You notice in verse 20 it's his disciples he's speaking to. He says, blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil
because of the Son of Man. But you see, the vital thing to the child of God, to the man of the new creation, is not what other people think of him. It is not their opinion or response. It is God's. And that's a mark of grace. What really matters to you? People's assessment of you? Well, now, the Pharisees were like that, you see. That's why the Pharisees really tried so hard to put on a front. That's why they were such brilliant hypocrites. They could act their way through any scene in order to convince other people that they may be seen of men, is Jesus' constant refrain. That's why they do. They give alms that they may be seen of men. They pray that they may be seen of men. They fast that they may be seen of men. That's their great interest. And Jesus says, when you pray, when you give alms, when you fast, do it in secret so that you are seen by your Father who will reward you openly. And it's a real mark of grace when the only thing ultimately in this world that really matters to you is God's assessment of you. That doesn't mean you're going to go out of your way to be boorish and unpleasant and obstinate and angular to other people and delight in finding that everybody hates your guts, if you'll excuse the phrase. But what it does mean is this, that you will be like the man who wrote that glorious hymn. It's not in many of our hymn books, "Courage, Brother, Do Not Stumble." And there's a verse in it which says, "Some will hate thee, some will love thee, some will praise and some will slight. Cease from man and look above thee. Trust in God and do the right." The only thing, in other words, that matters is the assessment of God. That's the mark of grace. Now let me turn with you to the revolution in our attitudes. That's the revolution that is the primary revolution in our values. The things that really matter to us, and above all, says Jesus, it is what we are and who we are in the presence of God. Now let me turn to the second of these, the revolution in attitudes. Looking at the time, there's a certain revolution in my thinking going on at the moment, and that is that we're probably not going to get through this tonight, but I promise you we will on another Sunday evening still to come. So do not despair or rejoice too soon. But let me turn with you to this second highly significant area. Jesus says, "I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who ill treat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Sinners do the same." Now, do you see what Jesus is saying? He is appealing for the distinctive life. He says, you need to be different. Do not be like them. The distinctive feature of the child of God is seen not only in the revolution of his values, but in the revolution in his attitudes. And he's talking here about personal relationships, concerned with the way we as individuals react to other people's treatment of us, or rather their ill treatment of us. And the reason is, of course, that if Christian living, if the reality of our Christian experience is tested out anywhere, it's tested out here. It's not tested out in a vacuum where you're far away from other difficult people. And that's often what many Christian people try to do, you know. They try to retreat from the world so that they will live in a nice, pleasant, peaceful Christian atmosphere. Beloved, so long as we are here in this world, even if you are with
All the choicest Christians you will meet, you will always find somebody who is really difficult and irks you and gets up your back and causes you endless trouble. So it's a fruitless search. You're always going to have to exercise the spirit of which Jesus speaks. And it's here that our Christian living is really tested out.
I say it's personal relationships for the important reason that this is not the biblical teaching for relationships between nations and governments, nor is it Jesus' teaching on our relationship with the state or with the law, so that he is saying to the law, for example, if somebody smites you on one cheek, turn the other, that the judge should do this sort of thing. It's an important thing in this area of New Testament teaching to recognize that the law court must never act as though it were an individual. That is saying, now the right attitude to this transgressor is love and forgiveness and turning the other cheek. The law court must never act as though it were an individual. And correspondingly, the individual must never act as though he were a law court. Taking vengeance, for example. God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. And God has given to the magistrate in the civil law authority to exercise judgment and take vengeance. But he has given to the individual the commandment to love his enemies. Do good to those who hate you, and love those who despitefully use you. Now, as in this previous section, we are not dealing here with something that belongs to the world of merely outward mechanical relationships. We are dealing with deep-seated attitudes. It's attitudes that need to be revolutionized. The attitude of and spirit of love, issuing in kindness and blessing and praying, instead of the attitude or spirit of self-love, issuing in resentment and retaliation and revenge. So it is not the mechanical outward performance that's the vital thing, but the inward attitude. Well, now let me ask you to look, as we draw to a close this evening, at all that Jesus is teaching us about. How would you summarize it? Well, the word in which it needs to be summarized is that simple word, love. Love your enemies. Everything else that he says is, in a sense, an exposition of that. But we need to go on to say that the Christian gospel has given that word an entirely new and different meaning. In the New Testament, love is not an instinct or feeling aroused by something in someone else. Love in the New Testament is an attitude of heart, are issuing in words and deeds, which is neither aroused nor quenched by anything in the person to whom we are showing it. And the attitude is quite simply this: it is putting other people first. It is putting them in my place and myself in their place. Now, that's why love can be commanded. You see, you cannot really be commanded to feel all emotionally disposed towards somebody. You can't be commanded to have some sort of feeling that is altogether foreign in the circumstances towards someone, but you can be commanded to put them before yourself. And you can be commanded to treat them in the way that you would wish to be treated yourself. And Jesus says that the place where this love is most going to be tested is in the whole area of your enemies. I tell you, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who despitefully ill-treat you. Now, doing good and blessing them and praying for them are the outgoings of this expression of love. And Jesus goes on to give us concrete examples of them. Verse 29, if somebody strikes you in one cheek, turn to him the other also. If somebody takes your cloak, don't stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you. If anyone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Now, what is he speaking about? Seems to me again that it's important to say that he is not simply describing a physical act, but rather an inward attitude. For example, I would actually find it quite an easy thing to be commanded by Jesus, if somebody smote me on the cheek, to turn the other. Because personally, I can't remember when anybody did that to me. Now, don't be tempted. But I can't, and I can't imagine that you've had many of these occasions. It's not a daily occurrence, is it, for most of us, to have somebody smiting us on the cheek so that we turn the other? But when were you last hurt by something somebody said? When were you offended and really deeply distressed by something that somebody said to you? Because so often it's the tongue that's the instrument of this sort of thing. When did someone speak spitefully or unfairly or unkindly about you? Now, when that happens, there are three things that you can do. First, you can retaliate. And Jesus has clearly ruled that out for us. Secondly, you can simmer, I think is the word, or stew for a period of time, you know? You might all the time be preserving a very pleasant kind of exterior when they meet you, or at least the stiff upper lip, but deep down you are simmering with hatred. And what is going on in your soul is, I will get my own back on them. Or, thirdly, you can exercise New Testament love and put yourself second and put them first. That's what turning the other cheek is all about, really. And you see, the reason that it's so important for us to grasp this is that the essence of the opposite of New Testament love is not hatred. It's self-love. And so often that is the area where we need to allow God to deal with us. And Jesus says, let that happen in your life. Another illustration is when somebody asks you for something. Now, again, I think the literal following of precisely what this says, while there may be occasions when it's entirely necessary, but the literal following of this is not something that many of us are called to. What it really is saying to us is, let the whole pattern of your life be such that the things that are important to you are not your possessions. That's the really important thing. Now, the world in which we live today, people, but he says, do not go on asking them back. That really is the tense in which the word is found in verse 30. He says, give to everyone who asks you. If anyone takes what belongs to you, do not go on demanding it back. He is really speaking about an attitude. And it's an attitude that is delivered from being obsessed with things. And it's that sort of distinctive lifestyle which is going to be the real testimony that the world so desperately needs in our generation. We'll come back to this revolution in a couple of weeks' time. Let me say to you as we close, many of you may be asking, how in God's name can we live like this? Well, I say to you again this evening, you can't, you know.
You just cannot. But Jesus can. And it's when he comes to live his life in you that the real revolution takes place.
We live in a world where everybody is crying out for revolutions. My dear friends, there is no revolution that is sufficiently adequate for the desperate needs of the world in which you and I live today, and this society in which we live, which holds inquiries into the selfish, rebellious life of its people in a nation like ours. There is no revolution that will touch that. But the revolution of Jesus, which gives us new natures and makes us new men and new women. Maybe that's what you most need of all other things in the world this evening. Let's pray together.